Hello, and welcome to Beamcast. This is the July 12th edition of the ShonenBeam.com podcast. My name is Jean.
My name is Drew.
My name is Clint.
And we'd like to email the show at any possible opportunity, ShonenBeam@gmail.com. One quick promo word for you. This week we're going to be taking a special retrospective look at the first half of 2010. We'll be posting a special episode of Beamcast this Wednesday, July 14th. So stay tuned for that on the website. Check it out, ShonenBeam.com. Big news this week, the World Cup has ended over this past weekend. Spain victorious amid some controversy that I'm claiming. I believe that they were diving quite a bit and embellishing in any and all contact, but whatever, you know. I will not begrudge Spain their first ever World Cup victory. Congratulations to them. Overall, I know, Drew, at least you were watching some of the tournament. How'd you feel about the tournament as a whole?
It was, I guess, all right. The matches where lesser teams were playing were probably better because less of the whole diving delay of game thing.
Right.
It gets frustrating very quickly.
Mm-hmm. I have to say that, having grown up as a football or soccer fan, this was probably the worst World Cup I've watched. Just the matches were not as good. They weren't as used to the actual ball itself. So the fact that it has gained so much popularity in the United States, despite being what a lot of pundits are calling one of the worst World Cups, is good. Also going on is EVO 2010. We are recording this on Sunday, while you might be listening on Monday or later. So as we are speaking, we're also watching the live streams of the Street Fighter tournament. So bear with us as we are distracted and perhaps screaming at action. But thoughts on action so far at EVO, Clint?
It's been pretty awesome. Earlier today is when all the finals were happening, and I didn't get up early enough to catch the Melty Blood, which is a great Japanese game that they're playing, but I did catch Marvel vs. Capcom 2 and Tatsunoko vs. Capcom. Really fun to watch.
Excellent. All right, well, let's move on to our actual content of the show, begin with our news segment. First up, Manga Toshokan, which has, for me, been my recommended online manga reader of choice. They have removed many, many series at the behest of an unknown publisher or publishers. Quite a few well-known titles, though mostly they seem to be completed series that have finished their publication run, with some exceptions. I believe you mentioned that Soul Eater is on this list, Clint.
Yeah, Soul Eater's off.
General thoughts on this?
I mean, it seems like everyone's caving to pressures from publishers lately, that they're just really cracking down on this. I don't know if there's also going to be an increased response in piracy.
I feel like this is still the middle of it. There's still probably more coming. I don't know what's going to come out of this. I hope it's legal manga streamed for a cheap price. I don't know.
I noticed, looking over the list, which if you head over to mangatoshokan.com, their most recent news post at the time of recording gives a link to the list of all the series that have been removed. And if you look that over, you'll notice that there aren't any series from Kodansha, Shogakukan, Shueisha. You know, the major, major publishers don't seem to have a hand in this. Or if there are some series, that, like, for example, Great Teacher Onizuka is on the list. That was a Kodansha series, Weekly Shonen Magazine. I get the feeling that it's more Viz stepping in, or an American licensor stepping in, rather than the Japanese publishers.
To me, it kind of looked like Tokyo Pop titles were the main ones on there, which would make sense in a lot of ways.
Right.
No, Ayori Aoshi was on there. That was also Tokyo Pop.
Which would lead you to think that this works hand-in-hand with the potential lawsuits from the publisher conglomerate that we mentioned about a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
So probably more news to come on that. Let's move now to other news for this week. Kudenai and Major are both including DVDs with upcoming volume releases. Volume 6 of Kudenai and Volume 78, which is the final volume of Major, are both going to include DVDs with OVAs.
Is Major going to be a retrospective one? Do we know?
Not certain, actually. At least not in the news post on ANN. Was there any description of the content of the OVA? I suppose it's nice to know that you're getting a bonus. Just a good series, at least from, you know, Clint and I have been reading Kudenai, and from what I hear, Major is good. Unfortunately, we get no scans of it in America. Other news related to manga releases, Nabari no O is ending with its upcoming 14th volume. We're not exactly certain when the 14th volume will ship, but the 13th volume did just ship on June 26th, so usually probably like a 3 to 4 month time span difference between volume releases. So Nabari no O, the modern ninja story, will be ending sometime soon. Have either of you read or watched this series?
Yeah, I'm by no means current, but I'm a good 20 or 30 chapters into it. That I've read through. It was enjoyable enough, if a little too many Bishonen characters for my tastes.
Right. Drew?
Yeah, it just keeps confusing me with Shion No-O, so know nothing about it.
I watched, I think, 17 or 18 episodes of it, of the anime adaptation. Again, found it enjoyable, but not groundbreaking, not really exceptional by any means. Fun, but, you know, there's a reason why I kind of lost interest around 17 or 18 and didn't bother to finish it. Some non-specifically shonen news this week, but still relating to the world of anime and manga. This is a story that is all too familiar to video game fans specifically. A mother in Florida has protested a public library carrying certain questionable manga, let's say.
Specifically Psychic Academy and Gantz.
Yes. Okay, the official story is that a mother in Crestview, Florida is upset over the fact that certain mature manga is available at her city's public library, and she claims that her teenage son was so affected by it that the son had to go into therapy. That's the formal news story. If any of you are video game fans out there, you've heard this with all the Jack Thompson nonsense in years past. We're essentially, and this is all opinion editorial and not fact by any means, but this is basically people trying to cover for their bad parenting by blaming it on some sort of establishment. I would assume that both of you somewhat share my assessment of this.
Yeah, that's one piece of it. Another piece is that the media is all too happy to report on this because video games and manga/anime are a competing resource with, like, news and television. So, of course, they're going to say everything they can to get people to not buy video games or anime or manga.
Right. They make convenient, easy targets the public doesn't know much about. It's parents' jobs to make sure their kids don't get mature material before they're ready for it. Certain knows, like, Gantz isn't appropriate for kids, but that's a parenting job, not like a library's job to make sure it's not accessible to anybody.
Absolutely agree. That's really disappointing.
While you're at it, remove all the romance novels because they have inappropriate words in them.
Yeah. Remove some of the most important works, literary works of our time and times past, simply because they deal with issues that are not acceptable to today's society. I mean, it's where does it end, really? It's just that those literary works are not as easy of a target because, you know, literature is more widely accepted than this newfangled manga or anime or video games, however the the issue of the day arises. So hope to see that leads nowhere. I believe she's protesting the library, and I would imagine there's going to be a lawsuit coming out of it. But usually, fortunately, the courts that have dealt with such situations have played the common sense card more often than not. I hope that they will continue to. Let's look now at the Oricon charts, the Oricon rankings for June 28th through July 4th. Not a very shonen-heavy week. The top five rankings are Team Medical Dragon, Volume 23, Claymore 18, Nurarihyon no Mago 11, Kyokoi wa Hajimasu 9, and Big Windup 15. Those are the top five. Not too much. There is some shonen on here. Nurarihyon no Mago 11 at number 3, debuting with first week sales of 98,185. Number 6 is Toriko.
That volume has a sweet cover.
Yes, it does. That is an excellent cover. That's the Toriko Tommy Rod fight. Really excellent art there. Steel Ball Run is at number 7, which began as shonen and kind of evolved into seinen. That's the newest adaptation of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, which you should all be reading. Anything of particular note on this list, guys?
I noticed the manga adaptation of Durarara is on number 2, or is on number 11, excuse me. Clint knows more about that than I do. But
yeah, Durarara is good. I checked out the manga a little bit. I have to say I'm a much bigger fan of the anime.
Sket Dance Volume 14, I see, is on here at number 12 with just under 70,000 in sales. First week sales, that's a little disappointing for a series that's been around for so long, but Sket Dance, not really one of the big players in Shonen Jump, so for a middling Shonen Jump series, that's acceptable, I suppose. Madoka Box Volume 5 is on here with just under 60,000 at number 15 on the list. That's okay. Kudenai, Volume 5 at 54,000. So, some shonen, just not
a depressing one is Siren at number 22.
Yeah, that's really unfortunate. That's Siren at number 22 with 46,629 in sales is below still One Piece 58, which is still hanging on there with this week's sales of just under 48,000. It needs to be better. I mean, Pyutofuku Jaguar Volume 19, which is the gag series in Shonen Jump, is only, what, 3,000 volumes less in sales this week than Siren. Siren is... I can't believe it's not more popular than it is. It's not the best series out there by any means, but it deserves more acclaim than it's getting from fans, at least I would say.
It's an extremely underrated manga. It's more popular with English-speaking readers is the big thing, probably.
Right.
It has a very intricate plot that is well set up.
Let's take a look at release dates for this upcoming week, then. The complete series of Black Cat is being released on DVD. It's the Viridian collection of it, retailing at a suggested retail price of $39.98. Did either of you read or watch Black Cat at all?
Read Black Cat. I heard the anime was significantly worse than it, though. The manga itself is decent. Not more, not less. But the anime is significantly worse.
Mm-hmm. I did not read much of Black Cat, and similarly, I did not watch much of Black Cat because I think I got two or three episodes in and found myself incredibly bored, so I wouldn't really recommend the content, nor really the price point yet. Golgo 13 Collection 1, which is the first 13 episodes on DVD, retailing at a suggested retail price of $59.99 for 13 episodes. Golgo 13 is actually, you know, a pseudo-recommendation. It's not nearly one of my favorites or anything, but it's pretty damn cool. But $60 for 13 episodes, absolutely not.
That is way high.
Yeah, that's really embarrassing, actually. Naruto Shippuden, the post-time skip Naruto, DVD Volume 11, which covers episodes 44 through 48, retailing at $25. Those are the episodes in which... this is when Naruto finds out that he's responsible for causing a bunch of destruction while he's under the influence of the fox, which includes Sakura having been hurt, and then Sai disappears with, well, I say
oh,
with
so the
Sai
immediate
and
aftermath.
Yeah.
So the immediate aftermath of action
yes.
in Naruto. It's not really worth a buy.
I wouldn't say so. If you're a completionist, get it, but only when the price goes down. It's not an immediate must-buy, at least. Manga... being released this week, we have Volume 35 of Case Closed, or Detective Conan, retailing at $10. Volume 35, I can't recommend as an entry point, so if you like it, you know, continue to buy it. But Hide and Closer, which is a former Shonen Sunday series, which, not exceptional. I believe it was either canceled or just naturally ended very early, but... nice to see Shogakukan releasing titles, so I would support them on that notion at least. Inuyasha Volume 50, I think that's Clint's favorite volume of Inuyasha, if I remember right.
Every volume of Inuyasha is my favorite volume of Inuyasha.
Relative to other volumes of Inuyasha.
Right. Nabari no O, the modern-day ninja series we mentioned earlier, Volume 4, retailing at $10.99. Again, you mentioned reading the manga. You gave your thoughts on that already. Yakitate Japan, Volume 23, retailing at $10. Are we all in agreement? Yakitate Japan, very funny.
Solid.
Yeah, definitely worth it.
Excellent. So now let us move to our current and classic review segment, where this week we're going to first take a look at Hayate no Gotoku, which is the story of Hayate, Ayasaki Hayate, a combat butler. What is it that we love about this series? Most of all, it's the comedy, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it's definitely the comedy. The jokes are great, and they're spread out, like, well. It never really gets, like, tired. They don't do the same jokes over and over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the comedy is absolutely just uproariously funny. And one of the ways in which it does that is by very often either referencing things or breaking the fourth wall or both. Yeah, if you are well-versed in otaku culture, you will get excellent mileage out of this series. Very specifically, unusually, if you're familiar at all with Gundam, the Gundam universe, there are a million Gundam references in this. And I'm not even really familiar with Gundam, but I know enough to know that it's in there.
They love naming Gundam characters.
Yes. The characters themselves, then. How do you feel that the characters are presented? In a positive way?
Yeah, I think they're all really well-rounded. None of them are, like, archetypical characters that are just, you know what to expect from. They all kind of, they throw you a curveball once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's set up in the harem mold, but it very much breaks from convention. I mean, harem tropes are used to good effect, but then they're kind of self-referenced and joked and twisted in such a way where the characters, you expect them to be one thing, one person, one archetype, and then, yeah, you're thrown for a loop in a very good way. And then there is one arc that is just of particular note that must be mentioned. We won't mention the name of the character after whom the arc is named, but there is one arc later on in the series that attempts seriousness for the first time in what is otherwise a very comedic series, and it pulls it off masterfully well. I mean, I was absolutely blown away and surprised by how well this series did serious when it wanted to.
Yeah, Hayate really went out of its way to try to do a serious, like, meaningful arc, and they blew it out of the water. It was amazing. It was just so well done from a series that you didn't think could do anything but comedy.
Right. Now, not everything is perfect, unfortunately. This is ultimately a strong harem series, even if it does tend to break from convention and make fun of, you know, some of the harem tropes. It is still ultimately the format of a harem series, so if you are anti-harem or just you don't find particular interest in harem, Hayate may not do very much for you. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I definitely think, like, if you're used to, like, harem comedy or, like, if you don't like harem or light romance, it probably won't have much for you.
And then speaking of light romance, it is exceptionally light. While it is mentioned and while there is a sort of love, well, it's not a triangle, but a love polyangle, if you were, there's a lot of introduction and there's a lot of teasing and hinting, but there's very little actual progression or resolution.
Yeah, they basically just, like, they'll toss little arcs of girls out in front of Hayate, but never really conclude on any one girl so far in the series.
Right. Adaptation, then. There has been a first and then a second season of anime. The first season was good. It was a solid good. It was really enjoyable. I watched this before I read the manga, and I was surprised to find out that much of the first anime season was filler. Surprised because it was actually very enjoyable, and that's something which is rather surprising of filler in general. Usually filler is of notably worse quality than canon story. But Hayate and its pseudo-episodic comedy tends to lend itself to filler, so I would recommend that as an enjoyable, not a wholly engaging series, but it's a fun adaptation. And then the second season was all just kind of more of the same. No filler, or if there is, there's maybe only one or two episodes of it from, I believe, a 13-episode series. Mostly canon and rather enjoyable. So then let's give a rating out of 10. Clint?
My rating is an 8 out of 10. It's a really good series. It doesn't do anything like special or amazing outside of the one series arc we mentioned, but it's a solid series that makes me laugh from week to week. It's always funny. So definitely a recommend.
For me, it's an 8 out of 10 as well. While it may not be, in my opinion, as good as other series that I would rate an 8 out of 10, it does everything that I want it to. It may not completely redefine comedy or manga for me, but it makes me laugh on a very consistent basis. And again, during that serious arc, I was just absolutely shocked at how high quality it was. So definitely strongly recommended in terms of comedy, if not just manga overall. Now let us look at the classic review this week, which is Yu Yu Hakusho, the Yoshihiro Togashi's first major series, in which Urameshi Yusuke is killed but pseudo brought back to life to take care of fighting demons, I guess is the simplest non-spoiler way to put this. What do we think about pros, cons in general? I think the most overwhelming pro is that if you like tournament fighters, this is a series for you, if not the series for you. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, the fights are varied and many and showcase a wide display of powers.
Yeah, the fights themselves I find to be particularly quality in the way that they use these different powers wielded by interesting enough characters. And the fights themselves, you know, they're action-packed, they're interesting, they're manly. But yeah, very specifically, those powers are probably the meat of how Togashi made a name for himself. You know, he would later go on to do Hunter x Hunter, which also would really clearly define sets of interesting powers. And that is one of the stronger points of this series, aside from being the archetypal but excellent tournament fighter, is the powers used therein. And fighting is no good if you don't have interesting villains to fight against. Would we say, on the whole, a good set of villains?
Yeah, most of the villains are really, really good. From the early villains, like the demon he fights coming into the first arc, to even the later villains towards the end of the series are pretty good for the most part.
Mm-hmm. And the vast majority of the villains in the series are good villains, good evil villains, and they make for interesting fights.
Now, the cons, overwhelmingly, it must be said, the ending is a considerable letdown from the quality of the rest of the series, and it has kind of become Togashi's stigma to come up with really interesting novel ideas and then not be able to see them through to completion, to an acceptable completion, to the level that we were expecting. And this is kind of the series that brought about that entire line of thinking. Were you as let down by the ending as I was, Clint?
Yeah, a lot of things just kind of fell apart at the ending, and there were some character progression choices made that I just really don't agree with.
Right. And then, yes, this is a very interesting tournament fighter, but you would like to see the tournament being used as the medium for storytelling. And while the tournament and the fight, the different fights are interesting, they're not really a backdrop for any kind of an engaging plot. There's no real plot depth, there's no serious character involvement or progression or anything.
I guess it's tournaments are just more about, like, building up the characters you're about to fight and, like, having the characters grow in the fights. So mm-hmm. it's kind of just the way it goes with a tournament fighter.
Fair enough. Now, adaptation, it did have a fairly long-running anime. What do we think of the anime?
I thought it was generally well done. Pretty much a faithful adaptation, and I really liked seeing the powers, you know, animated and colored in.
I think it adapts very well into an action section. I watched it to completion a long time ago and pretty much enjoyed it.
Okay. So then ratings, Clint.
I give Yu Yu Hakusho a 7 out of 10. It would be higher. It was a great tournament fighter, but it was a tournament fighter alone. That's all it was. And the ending was a complete disappointment.
Drew, do you want to give a rating to this?
I haven't finished the manga. The anime, when I watched it, I enjoyed it quite a bit. I'd give the anime an 8 out of 10, but I don't have enough of experience with the manga to rate it.
Okay. I give the manga a 7 out of 10, which I think is really a testament to how interesting the earlier portions of the tournament fights are, given just how disappointed I was by the ending and the real lack of any story to underlie all of this. Those fights and those characters and the powers were interesting enough to still keep this series a 7 out of 10 for me. All right, we're going to move now to the Great Shonen Tier List. Spoiler alert, we are going to be revealing lots and lots of plot details, so if you don't want to be spoiled on anything, move on to This Week in Manga. But we're going to begin this week with the ever-popular Rock Lee of Naruto fame. I'm going to take a look here somewhere between Rekka, of Flame of Rekka, and Sakura, who we've pretty much determined that Rock Lee would beat. I don't think that's a terribly huge surprise to anyone. So let's take a look at Toriko, since he happens to fall right in between there. How do we feel that a fight would play out between Rock Lee and Toriko?
I feel like Rock Lee probably releases his, like, can't stand up to Toriko normally. Toriko has more raw physical strength, but he releases the gates and gets the speed advantage, probably combos Toriko to death then.
Seems that way to me. Do we have any objection to him beating Asuna then?
No, I generally feel like Rock Lee is a little too fast for Asuna to keep up with.
Okay. Taking a look then at Akisame, shall we? Akisame of Kenichi. This is a very interesting martial arts battle.
Yeah.
Is Rock Lee a little bit too, you know, pseudo-supernatural with his just insane superhuman speed?
I do feel that Rock Lee's fast. I also feel that Akisame is superhumanly fast. And I feel like jiu-jitsu is kind of a natural counter to just the striking style of martial arts that Rock Lee uses.
I think Clint may have a point there. I would actually have to go with Akisame on that one. Akisame has also a fight experience. If you're going to have two people with lots of physical power packed into their muscles, I'd go with the one with greater technique and fighting experience. Rock Lee is more a raw effort character.
That's true. Do you think that Akisame would actually be able to catch up to Rock Lee with gates opened and defeat him?
I think he'd be able to dodge Rock Lee with gates open and wait until he cools down.
Okay.
I don't think it's a matter of dodging or catching up. I think Rock Lee comes in for a hit, and Akisame grabs him and either throws him or puts him in a lock or something, just completely disables him.
Okay. So then, Tokine from Kakashi.
I think that's Rock Lee before she can get a barrier up. It's a question of whether her Kekai would hold in the first place. I don't think she's fast enough to catch him.
I certainly don't think she's fast enough to catch him. If she puts a barrier around herself to protect from, you know, double gate opening, or I guess five gates, but the two gates that really matter, opening Rock Lee, would it hold? I don't think so.
It's tricky, but I'd have to give the edge to Rock Lee in terms of, again, raw power.
I will accept that. So Rock Lee loses to Akisame, but beats Tokine. Moving on then, Bleach fans, it's Renji time. How about I, Renji? We're going to look between, two other Bleach characters. He is very clearly canonically below Byakuya, but also canonically above Rukia. So this is a very narrow window here. We're looking at how he stacks up against Naruto and Yusuke in that order. So let's first take a look at Yusuke, since he's lower. How do we feel that Renji would fare in a fight against Demon Yusuke?
Yeah, in his Bankai, he has a little bit of blocking power. He can use it to hold off strikes from Yusuke's Spirit Gun. Do I think he has enough or can sustain the damage from that? No, I think Yusuke eventually overpowers him with the enormity of the Spirit Gun.
I almost feel like Yusuke would just punch the bone of his Bankai and it would just crumble.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that, actually. And then, just to make sure that's not a matchup thing, even though it doesn't seem like it, would Naruto pretty handily win this one?
Yeah. Gargantuan Rasengan.
Okay.
All over that shit.
Alright, so Renji goes below Yusuke. Let's take a look at an equal character in terms of fighting strength, Usopp from One Piece.
The king of snipers.
Safe to say we're looking a fair way down the list here, aren't we? Let's take a look at between Hayate and Gaama. So how do you think that he would fare against Kenichi?
That's a really interesting fight. I'm not sure if Kenichi would be able to dodge. Does anyone else have an opinion on that?
He's not so fast that I could see him dodging pinpoint accuracy and rapid fire that Usopp can provide.
I think Kenichi ultimately isn't at the level where he can dodge bullets. He's at the level where he can deal with guns if they're extremely close to him, but he needs the element of surprise for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we would give that one to Usopp?
Mm-hmm.
All right. What about Oga of Beelzebub?
I feel like that is sort of a raw power thing. Even if Usopp hits him with, like, rapid-fire explosive slingshots, which he can do, Oga's still probably going to stand up and keep going. He got punched into a bridge and got up.
Yeah. Clint?
Yeah. Oga definitely has some lasting power. I can see him taking a couple explosions and just kind of walking through them with that demonic smirk on his face.
Well, if the smirk is coming into it, then he clearly wins. So then it comes down to Usopp versus Gilbert Kent, with Mech, presumably. Could Usopp defeat a Mech?
I don't feel he could defeat a Mech. I mean, perhaps, you know, targeting the canopy, the pilot, directly.
Right.
Is it made of glass?
I don't think
so.
No,
I'm not familiar with this Mech.
Not that I recall, no.
Full metal Mech. I think then, yeah, you have to give the edge to the Mech.
Yeah. So we'll give that one to Gilbert, even though it's entirely possible that Usopp could use Usopp's spell and fool the idiot Gilbert. Krillin from Dragon Ball. Even though he is a human in the Dragon Ball universe, and he's the strongest human in the Dragon Ball universe, so we're going to look up a decent amount. Let's take a look between Rukia of Bleach and Yoshimori of Kakashi. So let us begin against Kakashi. Kakashi with his amazing eye hacks powers versus Krillin, who can Kamehameha by the end of the series. Got the Destructo Disc. But none of the Saiyan strength or ability. How do you guys feel that would play out?
Kakashi tries to eye hacks Solar Flare.
Ooh.
That could very well be a matchup issue.
Bad matchup for Kakashi.
Now, what if he doesn't... Does he have enough... when I say he, does Kakashi have enough aside from his Mangekyo Sharingan to defeat him anyway?
I wouldn't say so.
He does have the Chidori, but he can't fly. He doesn't have the kind of range capability of like a beam launcher like Krillin.
Krillin's going to be pelting him with energy bullets the whole time, at least. Okay.
So he defeats Kakashi then. Let's take a look at how he would fare against Vash the Stampede. Vash, not exceptionally fast, so are we at least willing to say that Krillin is faster?
Yeah.
Definitely faster.
He's definitely faster. He has range, he has mobility, he has agility. Honestly, the Kamehameha probably rivals, even though it's Krillin's Kamehameha, probably rivals the Angel Arm. I'm inclined to say that Krillin would take this.
Yeah, they blew up the entire moon multiple times in Dragon Ball with the Kamehameha.
With Kamehameha's less than what Krillin did.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's easy.
And then I guess it would come back down to Rukia. Would Rukia's just sheer speed take him out?
I'm inclined to say
that's an issue of Bleach character speed and Krillin not being super duper super fast.
Right. And I agree with that, so we're going to put Krillin between Rukia and Vash the Stampede. We reviewed Yu Yu Hakusho earlier, so let's put in another character from there. Kuwabara. Clearly, canonically, he is below Yusuke. However, let's look at above Maka and Soul. So how would Kuwabara fare against, let's say, Yoshina Ageha of Siren? There was a little bit of confusion over his powers, so let's try to attempt to explain what his powers are. Yes, he has the spirit swords, but by the end of the series, he gets the dimension-cutting sword, which is effectively complete disregard for distance. It's kind of a ranged attack without the lead-up to the range. So he
can portal gun with a sword.
Yeah. It's really tricky. So if he can just make his sword slash appear behind, in front of, to the side of any character, how would that target Yoshina Ageha with his supposedly very strong defense in Melchi's door?
Oh, I think that goes beyond just mere like blocking with psychic energy. I think if you can cut through dimensions, you can cut through psychic properties.
Mm-hmm. So he's going to defeat Yoshina pretty handily?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we just ranked Krillin, so let's compare Kuwabara to Krillin, then.
Well, I think, again, Krillin is Dragon Ball fast, and Kuwabara isn't. So it comes down to who gets the first hit, because I'm pretty sure if Krillin gets hit by the Giganto, he's going to be cut in half.
That's tough, but...
Perhaps we're looking at a case of mutually assured destruction here, where Krillin launches a beam at Kuwabara, and then Kuwabara cuts him in half, and then Kuwabara gets hit by the beam.
Right. That very well could happen. That's interesting. Let's move away from Krillin for a moment, then. What about Rukia? Is she fast enough to completely avoid wherever Kuwabara was intending to cut her through a dimension?
He does still have to move, and Bleach characters are, you know, faster than sight fast. That's why they're ranked so high on the list.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This so Rukia takes
is
that?
Where this edge kind of goes to speed.
Okay. And then below Krillin, then, is Vash the Stampede, who is presumably not fast enough to dodge a dimension-cutting sword. Would you agree?
Yeah, so that... I give that to Kuwabara pretty handily.
So then it does come down to how we feel the fight would play out between him and Krillin.
I'd be more inclined to give it to Krillin.
Well, even if the dimension sword cuts through dimensions and slashes Krillin, would it actually kill Krillin, or would it just hurt him?
He is taking...
If it can cut dimensions, it can probably cut Krillin. He's reinforced, but he is still a human.
Granted.
Hmm. I am inclined to give it to Krillin because of the thought that he could just fly while shooting Kamehameha or what have you at Kuwabara, while Kuwabara doesn't have anywhere near the same kind of mobility.
Yeah,
I think
would say so.
Krillin wins
in more
cases.
you could probably avoid being cut by the dimensional sword just by moving continuously.
Okay, that's halfway through our great Shonen tier list rankings here. Feel free to contribute your thoughts, shonenbeam@gmail.com. We're going to proceed now to Nijima Haruo from History's Strongest Disciple, Kenichi. And for all his bravado, for all his intellect, we are not looking very high up the list here. Let's take a look between Ippo as our ceiling and Katsuragi Kema of the world God only knows as our floor. So right in between, we're looking at... Let's take a look first at Ashirogi Muto from Bakuman. A rather intelligent tactical character with some form of weaponry. We at least established that he has mace and a baton versus two college kids who can draw manga.
Yeah, I kind of feel like they might they aren't mace proof by any means.
Plus, he creates dissension in their ranks.
The numbers game doesn't play into it. They're so weak that they can't gang up on him. And sacrifice, you know, Takagi to the mace for Mashiro to get the hit in.
You know, he is fast, so he could mace one, run away, mace the other.
He is a genius at running away.
Of course, there is also there's also the question of even if he maces one and the other lands a hit on him, it's a hit from a guy who draws manga or writes manga. Would it do anything to him?
Yeah.
Probably not. Let's look a couple above, then, at Utsuru Sanada, the main character of Lock On. The mace could play a very important role here, Drew.
Yeah, he has super sensitive eyes, so on one hand, if you hit him in the eyes, it's probably going to hurt him. But on the other hand, Sanada has sort of, like, genius-level martial arts potential, partially due to his eyes and partially just due to a strong body.
Right. So, I get the feeling that while mace could disable him, I don't even think that Nijima would have the chance to mace him.
I don't know. I think Nijima is very good at evading things, even if Sanada does have his genius potential.
I'm inclined to give this to Sanada. How do you feel about it?
I could see giving it to Sanada. It's sort of a tough fight, but I guess if you're going to put determination on the line, it's easily the more protagonistic of the two.
Well, let's see below him, then. Furuichi from Beelzebub. First of all, this would be a hilarious fight. There's no getting around that. Furuichi, not a fighter, but he's certainly nowhere near as weak as Haruto or Kema or Ashirogi Muto. So if he got in a punch, it would at least hurt.
It would hurt. I think Nijima is used enough to being hurt that he wouldn't be instantly taken down. But
Clint?
I think Nijima gets in a shot while Furuichi is, you know, eating grilled octopus.
A shout out to the current chapter, perhaps. Yeah, I couldn't see that. I'm not even going to have to qualify that statement, honestly. I see that one. So then it does come back to our argument of who wins between Sanada and Nijima, and we're split here. Do you have anything to offer to this, Clint? I know that you're not familiar with Sanada.
Not too familiar with Lock On, but I think I have a basic understanding of his powers. I would say that he would kind of be a little bit better than Nijima. Nijima is a great tactician. Maybe he could devise a way to get the spray into Sanada's eyes.
If it's in the city streets, it's probably Nijima, but just in an arena, I think just in terms of like body power, even if he gets maced, he's still probably going to have the body to outfight Nijima in a stall war.
I would agree. So I'm going to place Nijima below Sanada. Next up on the list is Sakurazaki Setsuna from Mahousensei Negima. She is the swordswoman with angel wings and a bunch of tiny knives and lesbian power. So how high up the list does lesbian power get us?
Obviously above Goku.
Clearly.
Oh. It matchup situationally beats Negi because he needs heteros for his magic to work.
That's a very good point. we're going to take a look here. We're going to put the ceiling at Gray Fullbuster from Fairy Tail, and as low as we're going to look, we're going to put the floor at Kagura from Kakaishi. So let's split the difference and look at Tomirod. How do we feel that a fight between Setsuna and Tomirod would play out? Again, Tomirod is the insect-using antagonist from Toriko. How do you feel about this, Drew?
I feel like Tommy Rod has a lot of distance situational control attacks. At the same time, Setsuna is used to dealing with... She's fought against Eva, who has warped reality during their fight, and she still managed to come out on top.
Right.
So, I'd be inclined to go Setsuna.
As would I. She's fast enough, I think, that she'd be able to dodge most of the bugs, not have to deal with most of them. And even those that she did have to deal with, she has more than enough of an answer to them, I feel.
I feel that's reasonable.
Okay. How about Kyle, then, from Siren?
Kyle, I feel it's an issue of they probably have equal speed abilities. Kyle has the ability to make a box that is a wall. So he could make it so that he could only be attacked from the front or something like that, which would nullify at least Setsuna's range advantage.
True. But would she still have enough power to overcome the barrier or even attacking him head on? Or conversely, could Kyle really scratch Setsuna? She's so fast.
I think he could probably force her to attack him head on. Beyond that, I don't know whether... Would a direct hit from Kyle hurt her? That's the key thing I'm wondering here.
I don't really believe so. It's kind of a tough situation, but I'm inclined to say no.
Okay, then give it to her.
This is a character that's been duking it out with Demon Negi for his training.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay. So then it comes down to Ueki Kosuke, main character of Law of Ueki.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's just a matchup nightmare for any character because of his wide variety of attacks. What answer would he have to her speed and swordsmanship?
He has wings of his own, first of all, and on the ground he has rocket roller skates.
Right.
So speed really wouldn't be an issue in the ground or in the air.
Nor would mobility or agility or anything. So taking that out of the equation... could Ueki hurt Setsuna definitely? Could Setsuna hurt Ueki?
I think they could both hurt each other. I think Ueki definitely has firepower.
Right.
At the end of the series to hurt her.
Definitely. But this is actually rather tricky. What are your gut feelings on this?
I kind of feel like Setsuna just recently, like the sword she got from her lesbian partner, which I've read grows stronger as more magic is channeled to her. The sword gets larger and just stronger, so it's basically an infinitely increasing sword.
And but then, does she need help to do that, or is that just...
That is the Pactio power, with magic being channeled to her. But
she needs
that,
magic to be channeled to her for that.
She has the swordsmanship techniques that, like, the series says can cut through anything, and
I don't know. I guess my gut would say Ueki, just because more attack options, and he's more used to landing a hit on extremely hard to touch opponents.
Right. What about the 10th bullet, the Mao bullet?
I think Mao bullet's definitely a killer if it hits, and I think just going by the end of the series, the fact that he's able to land a hit in an extremely tough situation, I think in the clutch, I got to give this to Ueki.
I'm inclined to agree. Do you strongly object to that at all, Clint?
No, probably not.
Okay. All right, so I'm going to place Setsuna below Ueki, but above Kyle. I believe we have a Street Fighter II HD Remix champion in Snake Eyes. It was an interesting fight.
Well done. I've been watching him as we talked, and he's been doing a pretty good job.
It's impressive. I'm just glad the Balrogs didn't win.
Yeah, same here.
Balrog. Oh.
That
horrible
was a
pairing.
Yeah. Enough. Moving on, thankfully. Miroku from Inuyasha. So below poison bees, but above women.
above actually, most women.
No, legitimately here, we're going to put the ceiling at Asuna of Maho Sensei Negima, but we're going to put the floor at Kenshin. So let's go right down the middle again and take a look at Ganta from Dead Man Wonderland. Clint, I'll leave this to you.
I mean, Ganta has the blood bullet. I kind of feel like if he fires that at Miroku, it's going to go straight into the black hole and not do anything.
Mm-hmm.
That's my gut feeling. If he's attacking from the front, anyway.
And Ganta is a normal human. He can't move behind him with, like, superhuman speed or something and fire it.
Okay. Sugata takes this. Or, pardon me, Moroku takes this.
Moroku takes that,
to say. What's something else that we can all discuss? How about Sakura from Naruto?
That's. I'd be more inclined to say that Sakura has ninja speed, and she can just, like, put a log in front and then punch Moroku in the back, and Moroku's still a normal human minus his black hole, so I'm feeling Sakura.
Yeah, I am inclined to agree, Clint.
Yeah, and I don't feel gender really comes into play because Sakura is such a mannish character.
Yes, of course. It is a bit of a joke, but yeah. So then it comes down to two series that I know predominantly. Damn. Well, you guys can at least chime in on Edward Elric, so let's do that one first. Arena manipulation versus a straightforward black hole.
I feel like no matter what elements you're manipulating, it's going to be hard if it's just a black hole sucking everything up.
Right.
Even if you create a wall, he'll just suck it right back up.
What if he, like, sinks the ground? I'm sorry, go ahead, Clint.
Ed has options. He can create spikes from the ground, and I mean, unless Moroku just holds the black hole beneath him or something like that, we've never seen him do that in the series.
He probably wouldn't do.
Interested to see what would happen.
Spikes are a good point.
Yeah, I'm inclined to believe even if it wasn't spikes specifically, he could, you know, raise the ground below him, so, you know, to put him 50 feet in the air and then dissipate the ground beneath him, or drop the ground and cave him in or something. I am inclined to give this one to Ed. We in agreement?
Yeah, I'd agree.
Okay,
yeah.
So that decides his position. Moving on, Aku no Jiro, the main character of Hajimete no Aku, which we have not discussed very much, if at all, in this series of podcasts. So let's introduce him as a character. He has a cape that can pretty much mold its shape into anything that he wants it to.
Usually something regarding arms, but it's variable.
Right. It is more often than not formed into a giant fist that punches things, but it's certainly malleable enough to be versatile. So let's take a look at below Alan Walker, but above Otago Hunt. Right off the bat, let's put him up against a mech, Gilbert Kent in his mech. How would that play out exactly? Mech versus mechanized cape thing.
Mech versus... I'd be inclined to say the cape could take more damage. And putting a comedy protagonist versus a comedy villain, or actually two comedy villains against each other.
Yeah, technically that's true.
Think of it, I'd be inclined to think that the cape could take more damage, and probably Jiro knows machine weak points better than Gilbert Kent would.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree with that. Let's look up at Ayasaki Hayate, who is nigh indestructible from most ordinary level blunt attacks. Also rather quick, certainly much faster than Jiro.
I think that's kind of where Jiro gets overpowered.
Okay. So then that's going to leave us looking at where he fares against Oga Tatsumi from Beelzebub. Certainly a huge reservoir of power in Oga that we do not see in Jiro, but would he have the chance to use it? He is still, behind that, an ordinary human.
I feel like, based on what we've seen of Oga, at least during the Demon World arc, I feel like just getting punched into the ground by a giant fish would still be able to do him in at this point.
Right.
In the series, it might be different, but I'd be inclined to give this one to Jiro at this point.
I think
Jiro has a wider, spiky smile.
Yeah, this could actually come down to a battle of the grins, and while Oga's is more evil, Jiro's is more well-defined, let's say. So that gives him the edge, clearly. It's nothing else that we talked about. It's the grin. And then finally, we're going to finish up with a series that we'll begin discussing the next time a chapter of it is released, and that's Kurenai's Kurenai Shinkuro. So Clint and I will be discussing this. His ceiling is Roronoa Zoro from One Piece, but his floor is Gilbert from Hayate. So how do we feel he'd fare against Shishio Makoto of Kenshin, Clint?
I kind of feel like he'd lose to Shishio. He is an exceptional martial artist, and he does have the demon of Hozuki power, where he can, like, grow the bone out of his elbow, and it like gives him superpowered punches, and he can also use it to block sharp attacks and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that he has an answer for like the flame sword and superior swordsmanship of Shishio.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. Lest we get too much into just me discussing things, let's jump down a couple and take a look at him compared to Hayate, which is a rather interesting matchup.
Yeah, they're both the same kind of person.
They're practically the same guy, except that canonically, Kudenai has some kind of ridiculous, powerful punch, where Hayate is just kind of all around indestructible and strong, but doesn't explicitly have that one move.
Yeah, he hasn't got his finishing move yet. That's canon.
That's right. Based on that, I'm kind of inclined to say Kudenai takes this. What do you think?
Yeah, I would say Kudenai beats Hayate based on the punch and kind of martial experience.
Mm-hmm. Which leaves it to me to compare him to both Gintoki and Alan Walker. Gintoki, I feel, is a strong enough swordsman to take him out. While Kudenai is canonically pretty much invincible against bullets, I don't think he really has an answer for the swordsmanship of Gintoki, who is certainly agile enough to get in enough slashes to take him out. Alan Walker, while he can't use his Akuma slaying sword against anything but Akuma, I still feel that his demon claw would be enough. It's strong enough in a supernatural series to take out Akuma, which is certainly stronger than Kudenai. And if it can defeat them, I think it can defeat Kudenai himself. So I am inclined to put him above Hayate, but below Alan. I know that you guys don't read those two series, but are you willing to accept that?
It sounds reasonable to me.
Okay, fair enough. So that concludes our Great Shonen Tier List segment. Be sure to check out the updated rankings when this goes up. Now we're going to move to anime discussion, because there is some shonen anime coming out this season. First up is High School of the Dead, Episode 1, aired recently. You guys want to talk about that?
Yeah, it was a great episode, I thought. Just in my opinion, the action of the zombies was hampered a little bit by the fact that this is from a doujinshi writer, and he does like to include a lot of fan service.
I feel like it was a great exploitation first episode. It had some fan service, but it did a very good job of setting up the rest of the show. It was interesting enough just as a zombie flick. It seems like it'll be the kind of thing that you'll read for fun, but won't get particularly deep. It'll be just like high school kids killing zombies for 12 or however many episodes it's going to be.
Yeah, it doesn't take itself seriously.
Also, Nurarihyon no Mago, Episode 1, aired, the adaptation of the Shonen Jump series. I watched this. I know, Drew, you watched this. Clint, have you?
Not yet.
Okay, so Drew, initial thoughts?
Initial thoughts, like, out of all the first episodes that came out this season, it was, in my opinion, the best one. It did a great job of setting up the main character, whose name I still haven't figured out, but the main character already seems characterized by his decision to live as a human, and the anime itself was enjoyable enough, seemed to give enough hints of what's going to happen later on, and definitely shows a sense of all the different yokai that are out there. There's definitely an artistic direction to it.
Right. Incidentally, Nura Rikuo is his name.
Oh, okay.
But that said, I kind of agree. I only really know that from being a fan of the manga. I don't think I could have told you that just from having watched the anime. Yeah, again, being a fan of the series, it was interesting to watch this episode with, you know, 113 chapters under my belt. They very much followed suit for an anime adaptation. It was by no means bad, in my opinion, first of all. It was just a little bit different than the beginning of the manga was, which you tend to see happen a lot, specifically with shonen, because the anime adapters want to get a lot of the intrigue, the suspense, a lot of the different plot elements right in the first episode to engage people to watch week after week, where, you know, in your first chapter you have 20-some pages, or usually in a first chapter you might get like 40-some pages to establish yourself. So they changed some things up. Some I thought were okay, some I didn't think were okay, but I understand why they did it. Overall, pretty good. It was not excellent. But I'm satisfied with it enough so far. Of particular note to me, I thought the incidental music was really, really quite good. And I have a bit of an ear for music, so I was really impressed by that. On the other hand, I thought the opening and ending themes were just absolutely abysmally terrible. I don't know if you noticed that one way or the other. I thought they were awful.
Oh, I quite enjoyed the opening and ending.
I just didn't think they fit the series at all, really. But I don't know
if they fit the series. I just, like, enjoyed watching them.
Fair enough. To each his own. But I will be certainly curious to watch that week to week. Now we're going to move to This Week in Manga. So if you have any comments, questions, additions, please feel free to email us, shonenbeam@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And let's begin this week with Bleach, Chapter 411, in which we have a reintroduction of a character that I don't think any of us expected to see, probably for good reason. Who's back, Clint?
Don Kananji, the king of
spirits.
King
are still
spirits.
Always with you.
Yeah. Feel free to do the pose and laugh at home, but if you do, you can also quit listening at this point.
Does that mean I have to quit doing the podcast? Because I kind of just did.
Damn it. we'll let you slide. You get a pass. You've contributed enough. Okay, so how do we feel? Certainly we are frustrated with the twist a week format of Bleach. And last week's twist was, oh, there's a footstep. Here's this foot of some character coming to either save the day or compound the protagonist's problems. How do we feel about the unveiling of this pretty effectively joke character?
Yeah, it's a joke. I don't know how I feel about a joke being told. It's not the best time for it. Aren't we trying to set up suspense, like a conflict with the main villain?
Yeah. Yeah, we are.
I feel like if this had happened earlier and just been the entire chapter and him getting cut down at the end, it would have been okay. Splicing this with the fusion ha that had occurred in the middle of the chapter was just abysmal.
Yeah. This chapter also brought up something extremely worrisome. Clint, you're absolutely right. We are trying to set up Aizen as this completely dominating villain. We've already done that to a great degree, but putting ourselves in a Bleach mindset, removing criticism for a moment, the objective that we were about to reach was Aizen was going to slaughter these friends of Ichigo to spur him to develop some more. So we're going to further establish Aizen as the bad guy, this really heartless, evil guy. Here comes joke character coming along, and he makes his joke little manly speech, and the other characters are going to run away, and he's going to cover for them. And Aizen decides to attack him, and he doesn't die. To me, that is a criminal error in storytelling when you're building up this villain. Do you agree?
Yeah.
Criminal error in storytelling pretty much describes Bleach.
And then at the end of the chapter, we get our one-per-week twist.
It's practically, at this point, our once-per-week Matsumoto sighting.
Yeah.
That last page, more than anything else, this chapter felt like it was spliced together because of the first two things. Matsumoto just showing up as a full page, the last page panel spread. What?
Yeah.
Didn't even fit with any of the rest of the chapter.
No. She's been supposedly chasing after Aizen and more specifically Gin this whole time. I wish that she would either do something or just not be mentioned. I don't really care at all to see her progress in reaching them. You know, far be it for me to say that I want a shocking character reappearance later, because we've had way too many of those in Bleach, but that works a lot better than showing us this same character continually en route to finding Gin. That's just embarrassing.
She's on her way to Mordor.
Give her a GPS or something already. This has taken her like 10 chapters.
Maybe if she was styling fashions like those people on the color page spread.
Oh my god, that was that cover page this week with Ichigo sitting there all moody and emo. Oh, that was bad. So let's move on now. One Piece, chapter 591, with the hot Crocus and Rayleigh bath scene. No, there's quite a bit to this chapter. So Rayleigh, in case you weren't aware, is badass.
He swam the comm belt.
That's just ridiculous.
He swam the comm belt and he killed a Sea King.
Just for kicks.
Yeah.
Not even because it was attacking him or because he had to. He probably could have just like given it a cup of milk, patted its head, and sent it back off to bed if he wanted to. Seriously, he's a ridic badass.
Yeah. Alright, so Trafalgar Law has headed out. With some rather ominous words, I felt. He's referencing Rayleigh, kind of ominously saying, you know, what is the Dark King thinking this time? D will almost certainly call up a storm again. Any thoughts on what that could mean, or is it just general foreshadowing?
I think he's just, it's more to the point that Luffy is about to get up to some things that will precede his name.
It'll make sense when we know what the will of D is.
Right.
This is one of those things that I feel is going to be a Lucifer and Biscuit Hammer type hint that we're only going to figure out what it means after we've actually seen what it means.
I found it rather interesting to find out that Rayleigh was caring for the Boa sisters after they escaped from slavery. I don't think we had been privy to that information beforehand, am I mistaken?
It was some moderately interesting tie-in. It was the first time we learned it.
Right. We had confirmation that Kuma, the way that we knew him at least, was working for the Revolutionary Army. So he did deliberately pseudo-save the Straw Hats by sending them to each respective island and locale to presumably train and get better. We, of course, have no idea the status of Kuma now because he's being modified and losing his humanity from the little hints that we're getting. But we found out for certain that he was on the quote-unquote good side. But then really the best part of the chapter is we get to see the crew, or parts of the crew. We get to see Usopp and Chopper. How do we feel about that?
Chopper was neat. His part was cute. And the last page with Chopper certainly foreshadows some new information coming out about Luffy.
Yes.
We don't know what that is, but the big thing is, of course, Fatsop.
Fatsop. Oh, that was fun. You had some comments on the island specifically that Usopp was on, Clint.
Yeah, I thought the island was really inventive. I enjoyed Usopp's part. I like seeing a giant, like, flower island that, like, eats things on it, uses this, like, collection of fruit that's available on it to, like, consume animals and stuff is pretty cool.
And then you mentioned the last page. The last panel of the last page is Chopper looking at a newspaper and being shocked by something else regarding Luffy. In my opinion, at least, it's almost certainly a bounty raise. Do you either of you feel that way?
Obviously.
Any predictions on how high we're going here?
It's going to get ridiculous. I mean, after the whole war arc occurred.
Is it going to get ridiculous? Because I feel they go much higher, they're going to be above Doflamingo, and I don't feel that, like, accurately reflects power. I would not be sure about whether the bounty's going to go up or, honestly, down, because he got thoroughly trashed during the end of the war arc.
If it had gone down, I don't think Chopper would be reacting in this way.
He might have been more of like a quiet shock rather than an expressive shock. I think it's still a possibility. It's not the possibility, and I'm not entirely sure either way, but bounty does seem to be what's going to come up next chapter either way.
I'm inclined to say it's going to be a fairly sizable increase, even considering that would put him above the likes of Doflamingo, perhaps, or Kuma. Again, in the world of One Piece, bounty value is not a power level. It is the relative importance against the world government. So, Doflamingo, first of all, that was his former bounty, as he is a Shichibukai, so even if it was power level, that would not be indicative at all of his current strength. But also, Luffy is more of a danger to the world government than Doflamingo is simply because of who he is, his relation to Ace, and therefore his relation to Roger, the will of D. There's quite a bit going for Luffy that would lend credence to him being of a bounty level higher than some Shichibukai, even if he might not necessarily be as strong as they are. At least that's my feeling.
Luffy doesn't necessarily have a relation to Roger, does he? He's from a different set of parents.
He doesn't, but I think just the fact that he is the sworn brother of Ace kind of keeps them on their guard.
I think the fact that he got into and broke out of Impel Down is going to be the key for the increase of his bounty, because Impel Down is the part of the series where he actually did things.
Right.
Well, I think I kind of agree with John on the subject. I mean, we know that he has the D name and that his dad is Dragon, the revolutionary.
Right.
So I kind of feel like they're gonna view him as a high priority target now because of his potential for causing destruction and damage.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure how much I like that, but I guess we'll see how it goes.
Right. Well, hopefully next chapter is just nothing but Usopp and Hercules.
Oh, I'd just like to see the whole crew in full page spreads again.
Yeah, of course, that's where we hope we're going from here. We need to see more than just these two. I mean, it was really fun to see these two, but I'm ready to see everybody again.
I want to see a couple one-shot style chapters of just, like, where everyone is and what they're doing.
Yeah. That was one area where I actually felt that the anime filler was kind of helping to expand upon their current whereabouts, because it was, if I recall correctly, I could be mistaken about this, but if I recall correctly, the anime, which expanded upon the mere brief mentions in the manga of where each of them had flown to, was somewhat under the supervision of Oda, so that they wouldn't mess up and give us another one of those, like, Zoro cutting steel before he's supposed to be able to cut steel. So, yeah, I would like to see a little bit more clarification, because it would be kind of unfortunate for all of them to reunite, and then the next time they get in a fight, then you see a flashback of how they gained their strength or something. Let's get all of it out of the way right now.
Yeah.
I'm actually kind of, again, of the reverse school of thought. I think, like, I'd love to get back into the action now and then see the flashback later.
Fair enough. It would certainly be interesting. I mean, overall, regardless, I do want to see the crew in some capacity. That's the
most
important
thing. Either way, it's still going to be One Piece. It's still going to be good.
Naruto, Chapter 501, continuation of this flashback of the unluckiest kid in the entire universe.
Yeah, it's getting kind of tough to watch, because we know the end result of all the events that are happening right now in this flashback,
mm-hmm.
and, like, seeing these characters, like, struggling for their lives, a couple of whom we know will eventually lose them, I mean,
yes.
it's difficult.
It was a fairly sad chapter, and it feels... While it's not the best flashback ever, it gives you a certain sense of monument.
Yeah. Very
important. Enjoyable enough.
To me, the thing that really held it back from being more enjoyable of a flashback was, again, Madara is not really that well established as a villain. He's kind of just the bad guy doing bad things because he's the bad guy. His motivation is... It's clear to an extent, but it's not really reasonable or intelligent.
The Moon's Eye Plan.
Well, yes. The methods with which he's trying to attain his power are certainly ridiculous and just outright stupid, but he doesn't feel like a credible, legitimate villain to me. So we have these really great moments, the scene between Kushina lying on the floor with Naruto and Minato heading out, you know, I'll be back soon. And, you know, again, mentioning that we know what happens to these characters, you get the feeling that he's off to die right now. Yes, those are really powerful moments, but they're kind of hampered, in my opinion at least, by the fact that Madara just isn't that great of a bad guy.
I guess. I still get the sense of catastrophe, because he's being an asshole here, even if he ultimately has, like, weird goals and an indirect way of going about them. He's still ultimately a catastrophe that's happening to this family.
Mm-hmm. We've theorized in the past that Kabuto, when he reappears to face off with Madara, that perhaps that Madara could not be Madara. You know, it's someone else in disguise, and Kabuto is using that information to blackmail him into working together. How interesting of a plot twist would it be if Madara actually dies here at the hands of Minato?
That would be pretty interesting. That would instantly make this flashback worthwhile for me. If we got a big revelation like that, like Madara actually died in this fight.
Would Naruto know enough information to capitalize on that, though?
He doesn't know anything about Kabuto, so I doubt he would be able to immediately do something about the plan.
Does he know about Madara to enough of an extent that, like, seeing this flashback in its entirety, learning that Madara dies, make him very suspicious about what's happening now?
I'm not sure about that so much. I think if that were to happen, and frankly, this is kind of an outlandish theory. It's an enjoyable one, but it's probably not going to happen. But were it to happen, I think it would be more for the sake of dramatic irony, giving the audience information that the characters don't know, rather than information for the characters to act upon. I mean, I hope this would happen, but I don't really see it happening. It seems fairly straightforward that Madara will probably kill Minato, and then the Kyuubi catastrophe happens, and everything plays out the way that we had expected leading up to the beginning of the series.
Mm-hmm. I guess we'll have to just see how that happens. Minato's going to have to at least do well enough against Madara to survive long enough to put the Kyuubi in Naruto.
Right.
Beyond that, what?
Yeah, not really too much information to go on there. Bakuman, Chapter 93. Did you know that Iwase is a bitch? because she is.
Hey, we're telling you.
This interesting chapter. We kind of a weird chapter. I'm not certain what to make of this chapter, honestly. I mean, it starts off focusing again on Iwase and her anger and her angst and resentment of just everything seeming to go the way of Ashirogi. And she's jealous of the success and the development that both Mashiro and Takagi are experiencing, not just in terms of manga, but also romantically in each of their own personal lives. And then it kind of completely changes. By the end of it, she's less the woman scorned and more the not friendly but the respectful rival.
Yeah, I don't know that I like where we're kind of heading with, like, everyone's figuring out that they have to compete against Eiji's works, and I don't want it to become like everyone cheering them on to, like, do better. They need significant rivals who really want to do better than them.
Right. And at this point, frankly, if Iwase is going to go down this road of kind of being the respectful rival, even though I'm sure that there would still be an edge to her, but more respectful than we've seen in recent chapters, really the biggest rival then, in my opinion, would be Fukuda, who,
yeah,
he hasn't gotten as much screen time, but his character has been consistent from beginning to now, which is, I want to be better than all of these guys, and I respect their talent, and I know that I haven't done as well, but I want to beat them.
Yeah, he would become the main rival in that case, and I don't technically disapprove of that, but I think having a more serious rival like a pissed off Iwase is good for the series.
Right. Now, of course, all of this is kind of detracting from the entire rivalry between Ashirogi and Eiji. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, that rivalry was never really, like, acidic or, like, bad feelings between them.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I would like to see more of that rivalry because it is such a good one, and I want to see how they play out in the rankings against each other. I want to view those battles each week as they're trying to fight chapter to chapter and take the place from Eiji.
Especially considering that was kind of the impetus for them to get back their passion for writing manga. You know, when Eiji came out on television and said, you know, my rival is Ashirogi Muto, and it was kind of met incredulously by all the listeners who, you know, maybe some knew who they were, but they didn't really see it that way. That Eiji, yes, he's a hilarious character, so of course there's the face value enjoyment of that, but he's really the driving force behind Ashirogi. I like Iwase. I've mentioned my like of Iwase's character for weeks now, but I don't want it to detract from the direct rivalry between those two camps, because that is why we fell in love with this series in the first place.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Okay, looking now at Beelzebub, chapter 68, where we get confirmation that Oga did lose. It was just the ending of that fight was hidden until now. So we were theorizing about ways it potentially could have ended last week. How do we feel now that we know what happened?
I feel vindicated because I predicted it correctly. I also feel angry because it was put off and wasn't just shown. It was the kind of thing that couldn't just be shown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't really feel that it was necessary to put it off whatsoever. It's not really a dramatic plot device whatsoever. It's kind of just messing with the readers in a way. Very specifically, how do you feel about the ending of the fight with regards to the fact that Miki didn't really consider it a win because he couldn't handle it? So Oga got trashed and even further humiliated because Miki wasn't at real full strength.
Yeah, I kind of, I mentioned this last time we were talking about it, that the technique damages Miki's hands, mm-hmm. and that's why it wouldn't really be a true win for him. And that's exactly what's taking place. So I'm wondering if, like, if something's going to happen to make that the lead horseman of the school a complete villain, like he's taught Miki this technique that just ruins his hands, possibly long-term damage is happening that no one knows about except for that horseman.
I think he didn't want to teach Miki the thing. Originally, he just like showed it to him and like Miki copied it, but it definitely does seem like I want him to be more of a villain. I want to see more solid villainy from this arc, like we saw out of the regular Ishihama arc.
Mm-hmm.
And volleyball isn't going to do it, although it's going to be hilarious. And it's coming up.
It's definitely going to be funny. It's just, is that level of comedy what we want? I mean, we've always appreciated comedy in Beelzebub, and it's been done expertly well when it's been done. But is now the right time for that? I don't feel that it is.
Yeah, I'm ready. We've had enough comedy chapters, and, like, we came straight out of the Hell arc, which, well, like, everyone was looking forward to, and it wasn't drawn out enough. We introduced a few of these characters who are plotting against Bael, and then we didn't really elaborate on them. I want to see some action happening and some plot going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, action did happen this chapter in some capacity. We had a fight between Oga and Tojo, which Tojo was pretty much handily in control of, basically calling out Oga as having become weak. I commented in the review of the chapter on the website that I found it a bit sudden or confusing the way that Oga has become weak again. I don't mind it when a character, a main character, is, you know, surpassed in power or comes up against new, stronger opponents. That's very much a shonen tradition. But there wasn't really a clear definition of how or why this happened. It's just kind of all of a sudden we're made to accept the fact that other characters are stronger than he is again. Did either of you feel that?
My stance about Oga and Tojo was that Tojo was always stronger than Oga. Oga just managed to get in a lucky hit when he was sort of at the peak of his adrenaline and fighting at full power. I think Toga still has the edge on Oga in many ways, so long as he's not using full demon power.
Okay, Clint, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it was mentioned that Tojo put in some work ever since his fight with Oga. He's been training, and I guess maybe this is meant to show that Oga just hasn't been training at all, hasn't tried to power up at all since that fight. He's been off gallivanting in Demon World, not really doing much.
Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't all a loss. Baby Bio was pretty damn funny, awarding the victory to Oga.
That was awesome.
Win by decision.
Tojo arguing with Bael was just so awesome.
That was great. And then now it is time, in fact, for that school festival to happen. So I'm anticipating kind of fast-paced, smaller events leading up to the major volleyball battle. And then probably during that and or after that, we'll see the recurrence of Oga versus Miki, and then somebody, presumably Tojo, I guess, versus, what was his name, Izuma? The head of the horsemen?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think it was Izuma.
Really, just, I feel that Beelzebub's kind of confused where it is right now. I hope that it straightens itself out soon, because it's still an enjoyable read, obviously. It's just that we keep finding ourselves week after week talking about how certain things feel out of place, certain things are letting us down. It needs to regain its focus on what's really important. What's really important to us is Fairy Tail 191. Or perhaps not so much. So we have, the beginning here is the three Dragon Slayers fighting off with this mech, which, that's always great.
They're somehow fighting with magic support against the mech with possibly the dumbest name ever that is supposed to nullify magic.
Oh, yeah.
The Dorama Animu.
Yes.
Like something a new fag would say.
Yeah, I am almost entirely certain that Mashima picked that name simply because it sounds like a catchy kids thing. It just sounds like one of those cutesy little things that is easy to say for a kid.
I don't know. I did not like the majority or all of this chapter.
No, I didn't either. I'm certainly not a Wendy fan, but I've always... Basically, I feel that there's sort of gender inequality in this series, and believe me, I am not a feminist or a champion of gender equality by any means, but Wendy, I've been hoping, since she was introduced as the female Dragon Slayer, I've been hoping that she would be important or strong, not necessarily to directly rival Natsu, but to be somewhere on the same wavelength, on the same level. And she and Gajil and Natsu all come out, and she's immediately the cleric, the support, and that's it.
She's casting support magic, and that's it.
That really disappointed me.
She, for someone who just delivered a kick, to be worried about two missiles heading at her,
yeah,
I feel like that's inconsistent with even the last chapter, and that's the mark of a weak manga, even aside from the end of this chapter, which is something that should have been done 15 weeks ago.
Yes, that was ridiculous. So before we get there, is there anything else worth talking about? Oh, yes, there certainly is. My goodness. So we have this, we have the fight between the mech and the three dragon slayers, which is just straight up action, not terribly exciting, but, you know, take it for what you will. And then we have a scene between Panther Lily and Mistagon. And it's revealed that Mistagon was defeated on purpose so that he could save Panther Lily.
Two words. Bullshit.
That's ridiculous.
That's dumb. For Mistgun being the powerful character he is, why now of all times, when we're finally getting him unmasked, seeing him with the reason, really, to fight at full power, purposely sandbagging against the one person you'd think he'd want to go all out against? It strikes a blow for his characterization, and he hasn't had a whole lot.
It strikes a blow for anyone that thought fairy tales writing was above fan fiction level. That's just awful. That is just inexcusably terrible to have this character. Oh, you only lost because you were intentionally losing. That is literally third grade writing. That's tripe. And it's certainly not helped by the art. Take a look on shonenbeam.com, the review of Fairy Tale 191, why don't you? Facial structure. At first I thought to myself when I saw this, like, okay, there's something clearly wrong with Gerard or Mistagon's face here. Maybe it's just an optical illusion caused by the face paint on the one side. No, it is very distinctly, I've checked this with quite a few people now, and including both of you. That is just completely 100% wrong, is it not? His right eye, our left, is just by far and away too low and too far off to the side, is it not?
It's just classic off model. I don't see how they didn't edit that out. It's pretty obvious.
Yeah. That's embarrassing. And then you mentioned at the end of the chapter something that should have happened tens, dozens of chapters ago, perhaps, at this point. Erza versus Erza is looking like it's going to start to be settled. Who knows? Because we thought it was going to be settled way back when. You wouldn't expect him to, again, tease us and then not deliver, but who knows? It could happen. Hopefully this will be resolved, because it needs to have been resolved quite a while ago.
I was interested in this fight at first, but then a cut off in the middle of it cut to an unexpected conclusion with absolutely nothing resolved, and then just gives us this, which is ridiculous and drawn out.
Yeah, very, very disappointing chapter overall. I completely agree with the king. This is bullshit. Okay, moving on. Hayate no Gotoku, Chapter 279, which is the resolution of the little mini-arc featuring Chiharu. I found this to have one of the more excellent punchlines in recent Hayate memory. How do you feel about this one, Clint?
Yeah, it was pretty good. They had the whole, she was staying there, but it was kind of melancholic, and they were like, well, you should go back to your family. And she's like, all right. So she leaves, and she goes back to her family, and their house is burned down.
So you get the classic Hayate last panel, which is either fourth wall breaking or super deformed characters making some kind of sardonic joke or something. And indeed, that's what it was. It was dry humor at the end of it again. I need to rent a room. not too much content in this chapter, although you do kind of get the feeling through through Ayumu's really bizarre metaphor, likening what's his name's the little boy Wataru's situation to a bar of soap, was it?
Yeah.
You get the feeling that she is going to be more involved.
Yeah, and then Nagi using the same metaphor later on, but correcting, well, like a bar of soap, but can't be thrown away.
Just all around a very good comedy chapter. I particularly loved it when Nagi and Chiharu were playing video games. And at the end of it, Nagi's kind of worn out, saying, whew, I need a meal. I haven't gotten that much exercise in a long time. And Chihara's just kind of thinking to herself, exercise? Yeah. We're playing virtual on.
That was pretty good.
Again, as we mentioned earlier in the review, if you like references to popular culture, you will love Hayate. This was no exception. There was a Gundam reference in the first page. She was playing Splinter Cell, and then she got chastised for playing Splinter Cell because she's under the age rating, so she switched to virtual on. Really funny stuff. Let's move on now to Kakashi, Chapter 313. I believe someone here may have been excited over this chapter. Who was that?
I was really, really extremely impressed by this chapter for a couple reasons. The first one being that this is one of two things the series has been building up to from Chapter 1. In the first chapter of Kakashi, we get this initial explanation of how Karasumori works, how there was just a lord who drew in powerful demons and the exorcist who worked to prevent them from taking over the castle. And in this chapter, we get the reality of it, which is significantly different. Tokimori basically ran a con to get in with the lord's daughter and then took the power of a Shinryuichi and injected it into his newly born son's body, which is just wow.
Yeah, I suppose I wasn't as blown away by it as you are, which tends to be a recurring theme with Kakashi. You tend to like it a lot more than I do. Certainly, it was by no means a bad chapter. It was actually quite a good chapter. I'm not really thrilled by this flashback overall. I'm not really thrilled by the character of the Founder in his entirety, really. But definitely a very good explanation and a good enough twist of the explanation that we had come to think of the beginning of the series. Do you think that this is going to wrap up the flashback fairly shortly in its entirety? I mean, we kind of are
like
out
a
of it.
It's like a flashback.
Okay.
We're sort of halfway through it. We're just going to need to see what kind of drama happens. There shouldn't be too much of it. I feel like just seeing it presented in a different perspective after all the time of just having to go with the halfway explanation
right.
just makes a big difference to me.
So that's a major point of plot handled. After this... Yeah, still hard to see. I mean, do you feel that Yoshimori is going to react in any particular way upon finding out all this information?
I think he already knew that there were things that were fishy about the original backstory he was given. Just finding out what they are, I don't think they'll have an immediate effect on him to begin with, because he's definitely matured a lot as a character since the beginning of the series.
True.
I think the obvious direction the series has to go now is who's going to be able to beat the Founder? Which comes down to a very select small pool of people.
Do you have an answer to that question? Because I can't really think of very many people.
It doesn't seem like there's anybody who has that capacity right now. Somebody'd need to go through a massive power-up.
Okay. Which is certainly something that could very well happen. We're going to move on now to History's Strongest Disciple Kenichi, Chapter 389, which is the fight between this Yami spear user and Akisami Koetsuji. Thoughts on this one, Clint?
I thought it was a pretty good fight, and exactly what the series needed, which was a good bit of just action and a solid fight with no fan service in it. Him grabbing onto the spear and then using his foot to grab onto like the ceiling or the chandelier or whatever and holding the spear in place, that was pretty funny.
Yeah, not even just funny. Yes, it was amusing because it's completely unrealistic, but it was a pretty cool moment.
Yeah.
This is sort of going back to what we originally expected from these fights, just like regular back and forth based in reality, but obviously ridiculous martial arts, and a little bit of banter back and forth throughout the fight.
Yeah, we find out a little more about the Eternal Sunset or whatever.
Yeah, the spear user kind of alludes to the concept that, you know, all these Ryozanpaku masters have been hiding their powers and staying, you know, keeping to themselves, and... You know, Akisame should rejoice because a world where all these masters can unleash this power freely will soon be upon them. So you're wondering, what exactly does that mean? Does that mean that there's going to be an all-out war that they're attempting to bring about, where, you know, there's such chaos and anarchy that they'll have to be fighting all the time? And what were your thoughts on that comment?
Yeah, I kind of thought that it was just a sign that they were trying to start a serious, like, in-public fight. Yeah, basically a war. Get a war going, and that would be really interesting if it actually happened for Kenichi, but I doubt we'll ever see that fully come to pass.
I almost kind of hope we do see the outset of it. It would bring back memories of the end of the whole Death Match of Disciples arc, where you have the masters taking on this whole army, or at least a private army full of tanks, helicopters, what have you.
Mm-hmm. So basically a very short chapter, very, very fight-centric, and we're anticipating pretty much the same next chapter between Ma and the female martial artist?
With significantly larger amount of fan service.
Well, yes. Which I'm not terribly thrilled at the concept of, but at least we got this chapter in between, I suppose.
Yeah, and Ma's fights do tend to be fairly technical, even if they are interspersed with fan service.
Right.
Yeah. When Ma fights girls, though, he has the stripping technique.
Yeah, so it's coming. It's just...
How's he going to do it with one arm?
At least this time, I mean, we're expecting it from Ma. That was the thing that was most insulting about it happening with the Shigure fight, is that, yes, we've seen plenty of fan service in the Shigure fight, but this was just uncalled for levels, brand new levels of fan service. We've come to expect it with Ma, and there's an actual, it's written into his character, I guess is the best way to say it, that he's going to be trying for this. So it may not be the best thing out there, but it's not going to shock us and disappoint us nearly as much as Shigure's fight did. Okay, The World God Only Knows, Chapter 105, which is the outset of a very peculiar three-way date, accidentally. I believe, Clint, have you caught up on this series?
Yeah, I'm now caught up, so I can discuss it with you guys.
Excellent. Welcome. I guess, actually, since this is a fairly new series for all of us, what are your initial thoughts on the series as a whole?
I like it a lot. I mean, it's definitely an amusing comedy romance type series. Very, very twisty romance, not exactly what I would call a romance.
Right. Okay, so this chapter we have the makings of just a bunch of different misunderstandings. Drew, why don't you take us through what you thought of just the series of the comedy of errors, I suppose?
It was interesting. It's obviously something Kama's setting himself up for by asking for Tenri to take him over by the park. And at the same time asking Kakua to come with him. So he shows his sort of density towards real girls, and at the same time sets up for what's going to be at least a little bit of rivalry-fueled double dating.
Right.
And I don't know how I feel about that. I feel like, again, I'd rather just get to solid plot again, or else just get to the next girl he has to capture. I feel like this series works best in episodic format, and it's been deviating a little more from that recently.
Mm-hmm. I don't mind exploring Kama's worrying over the fact that he's going to be, you know, locked up in this format forever, always capturing these demons. But, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's been too long. I don't mind it kind of intersplicing different arcs, but this has been one individual instance of it taking too long between major arcs. Clint, any particular thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. We've spent a little too long in between two places, and we need to get to the next place by now.
Okay. Well, let's get to the next place ourselves. Maho Sensei Negima, Chapter 295. Get to see a little bit more from this character that Clint knows and loves now. So, Clint, thoughts on Zazi?
I mean, I don't know what to make of her powers, if you even want to call them that just yet. I mean, it seems reality warping and just completely overpowered. I mean, Fate's group had no idea she was there or who she was. And she seems to have, like, brought them into the real world, mm-hmm, just by wanting to.
Yeah. That's a little bit ridiculous, honestly.
Yeah.
If there isn't some kind of a catch or a quirk or some weird twist to this power, and she just is this powerful, I think I might be a bit disappointed, because... yes, she has been saved for so long, but that doesn't mean that you just have license to freely reintroduce her as this supremely powerful character.
Yeah, it's sort of... the immediate impression I get was Wooly. I mean, I got a lot of feelings out of this chapter that, like, Akamatsu was deliberately playing with it, a lot of the comments made by the various class members, but... the immediate impression I get of, like, a character with extremely broken abilities showing up suddenly and just messing the plot up, the immediate impression I get is like the kind of Wooly turn where they just mess things up and accomplish nothing. I was expecting a little bit different, I guess.
Yeah,
I did like the moral dilemma presented by her, like her assuring Negi that the path he was on was leading straight towards what Chao, who was his descendant, was trying to prevent, and her telling him that, like, hey, I'll transport you guys back to the real world, none of you will be hurt, and you can prevent this, like, extremely riddled with bloodshed future that you're hurtling towards. It was an interesting moral dilemma.
Yeah, and the way that Negi faced it was also equally interesting, the way that he's saying, no, this is what I've set out to do in the footsteps of my father, I'm going to do it this way. But it's a little bit difficult, on the other hand, to really make a concrete decision on how we feel about that, because we just really don't know anything about where this is going after this. What, you know, yes, some random character that we've never known anything about shows up and says it's going to be a bloody future if you keep doing what you're doing, but what does that mean to us?
Yeah, I'm kind of under the impression that people, like, it's something that the characters know more about than we do at this point.
Mm-hmm. There was one character who was aware of Zazie's reappearance who said that Zazie came at this character's request. Do we have any idea who that is? It's just some person in a hood?
Yeah, that hasn't been revealed yet.
Given that she mentioned Shao, it could almost be Shao.
Yeah, it's going to be a huge reveal. Maybe someone from the class, maybe Chao herself.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea. But it's
got to be somebody we know.
Yeah.
Because somebody's from the time of the Thousand Master, perhaps?
Could be.
It's possible. I'm not entirely sure I like Zazie thus far. Sorry to break your heart there, Clint. I know you've been waiting for her for a long time. It's just to suddenly show up. I mean, the characters even kind of, in a silly way, reference this themselves, where, you know, what the hell is this? There was absolutely no foreshadowing. This character we know nothing about shows up all of a sudden and is broken. It was a moment of comedy, but in a way it was kind of a nod to the fact that this is all just completely ludicrous, and I kind of agreed with the characters when I don't think I'm supposed to.
Yeah, I don't know. I get the feeling there's some shenanigans going on with her power. It isn't just absolutely this impractical. There's something going on.
There must be.
Maybe she has to break a finger every time she does it.
I've run out of fingers, damn it. All right. Siren, chapter 126, which, my goodness, I do believe that you were right, Drew. Not to say that I perhaps would not have come to this conclusion myself, but yes, we do seem to be coming towards the possibility of a series end. He's certainly leaving it open to that, because for this ridiculous amount of romantic progress to take place in one chapter after... I mean, when was the last mention of it, like, legitimately? I think it was, there was a little moment of worry before this trip to Siren, if I recall correctly.
It was when she busted out her dark side during the previous trip to the present, I believe, is when it was.
Right. Other and then absolutely that, no mention of it, and then all of a sudden just outright saying, I love you, and there's a common understanding between the two of them, and they just kind of embraced as they're in this hyperbolic time area. So, yeah, very much... setting up for a lot of different plots to be resolved should the need arise, which, you know, judging by Jump table of contents is entirely possible, although there is a little bit of buffer again now with both Shonen Chico and Metallica Metallica. Otherwise, this chapter was pretty straightforward setup chapter. It was pretty much everyone just in transition and en route to the stronghold. Any real thoughts, any concrete ideas on what this chapter was?
Well, I think it's just splitting people into groups, getting ready for the heroes. Amamiya and Ageha will show up at decisive times to save the day.
Mm-hmm.
And again, what could be a finale, because they're getting what is really almost an ultimate power up.
I understand the reality of having to set up for a conclusion at this point because of the poor rankings in the table of contents of Shonen Jump, but... storyline-wise, just even if they are... Let's say that the heroes go in and just completely demolish this stronghold. You know, thorough, flawless victory for them. That still doesn't change their original goal, which was to have prevented this entire future from occurring in the first place. Are we just going to leave that future, or that entire storyline completely unattended?
I think the trick there is that if they can beat their enemies in the future when they've had their power-ups of their own with the meteor... there's nothing to stop them from just doing it in the present. And they might almost leave it at that. Like, if they can defeat him in the future, they can do it anywhere. And a lot of plot threads, certainly not all of them, could be resolved by just, in this trip to the future, defeating the entire Y stronghold. Yeah. Not to my satisfaction, but it could be done.
Yeah, I would agree. Okay, Zettai Karen Children, Chapter 223. Why don't you give us something on this, Drew?
Well, it's just sort of set up for what is clearly, in contrast to the previous arc, major filler. Mostly just, like, the children glomping onto Minamoto and forcing him into a beach trip and Sakaki trying to be the wingman for Tim and Bullet again.
Yeah. Yeah, quite a bit of fan service. Can't really say I was too big of a fan of this chapter, honestly, simply because of that. It was no real meat to this chapter, no real plot advancement, no real character development. It was, well, there was a little bit of character development, I will say. You know, Kaoru finally admitting not only to herself but to her friends that she is going to try to become a little bit more feminine. That's, you know, we've had that hinted at us, but it's never been explicitly revealed. But yeah, for the most part, very lighthearted chapter.
Mm-hmm. This just felt like a very minor chapter, not a lot happening. The only really dramatic panel was the one on the last page where Feather just breaks out, mm-hmm. which is a bit abrupt, I feel.
Yeah, really didn't know what to make of that, honestly, because if this is just a lighthearted, fan service-y, fun chapter or fun series of chapters, because it was a part one. I don't recall the title of the chapter, but it was title of the chapter part one, so there's more to comment, presumably. If this is just for fun, why are we going to jump right back into Feather's business right away?
Slightly apprehensive about what's going to come out of this chapter, but I really don't know yet, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a look now at Good Ending. We had two chapters this week, both 41 and 42. Let's try to split up this discussion briefly. 41 was the aftermath of the immensely disappointing chapter 40. So now there's the results of Seiji and Yuki finding out that Sho now again likes Seiji. Any redeeming aspect to chapter 41, Sho?
It's not games, it's practice. Just practice.
It's just practice. I was especially frustrated by Yuki in chapter 41. Yes, she has been revealed to be this conflicted character for pretty much the entire series, but she had sort of started to come out of her shell a little bit towards Seiji, and now it seems as though, faced with any obstacle at all, she completely retreats, very explicitly any obstacle relating to Sho. I'm really upset. Yes, I understand that you have to draw out the conflict, the romantic conflict in this kind of a series, but there's no reason why Yuki can't go after Seiji a little bit, and she isn't.
I'm a little bit frustrated by that. I can sort of understand character-wise that she still has reservations. I think the thing is that the triangle stuff is still somewhat tedious and needs to be toned down. I feel like this didn't do it as badly as chapter 40 did, but was still kind of bad about it. I think the core relationship in this series, Yuki and Seiji, is a strong one.
Mm-hmm.
And that if that is focused on, it could be a strong series, but it really just all depends on whether he can do that or not.
Yeah, I can even go so far as to say that I wouldn't mind if there was also a little bit of focus also on the relationship between Seiji and Onuma, just for there to be some kind of conflict. But yeah, I mean, I totally agree. The most interesting thing by far is the relationship between Seiji and Yuki. Now again, there was a second chapter this week, chapter 42, which was just so many formulaic turns of plot here. Seiji, having been confronted at the end of chapter 41 by Sho as to whether he likes Yuki, basically just chickens out and says nothing at all. Yeah.
It was essentially the standard male harem protagonist response.
Yeah, very, very disappointed there. And then Seiji, again, you know, stammering also towards Yuki. He's messing that relationship up also, which is, yes, he is the male protagonist in a harem series, but I mean, he even had been better than that just a few chapters ago when he was in Yuki's room talking to her. He was more driven, more motivated, more direct. Yeah, so this is a little bit uncharacteristic of the progress he had made. So it kind of letting the character himself down from the author there. There's a little, what should have been a date, which turns out to be a group dinner at a family restaurant over a Sunday with both Yuki and Sho. Really bizarre, awkward conversations about the past between Sho and Yuki. But then finally, the last page, it certainly doesn't redeem both of these subpar chapters, but it was enjoyable, wouldn't you say?
I think it does do a partial redemption, like at least shows that Seiji realizes he was being sort of the generic harem protagonist, not really being decisive. Mm-hmm. And if he follows up on quitting morning practices like he says he's going to do, then I think that's a step forward in terms of character for him, or at least a step back to what he's been, which is already pretty good.
Yeah, I completely agree. I liked seeing that statement, which is, you know, the first sign in several chapters of any real ambition towards this relationship with Yuki, and then Yuki's reaction, which is the smile, the turn away and the smile. That was good. So a good moment. Disappointed that we had to, you know, suffer through the last few chapters to get to that moment, but it is the right decision. Again, you are right, assuming that he actually sticks to his guns on this one. Metallica, Metallica, Chapter 8, which is the battle between this main trio of Luca, Gatto, and Shino versus the Electigra, or the Electigra, or however that is intended to be pronounced. So we get to see bizarrely scientific action here. Were you kind of weirded out by just how detailed and technical this became?
I was kind of entertained by it. Like, okay. I said the last chapter was the one, first one that entertained me. This one, I was sort of getting into it. It felt like one of a decent chapters of Law of Ueki, where they just take science and randomly are able to turn it to their advantage. It's neat how they were able to turn, like, metal wrapped around the electric tiger into a solenoid. Neat how electricity was sort of Luca's kryptonite, since he has metal-based powers. And then the railgun bit at the end was just a nice little icing on the combo cake.
Clint, thoughts on this chapter?
It was pretty enjoyable for the most part. I've been kind of like just gray on the series, didn't really know how I felt about it, but if it moves in this direction, if it continues to go the way it is this chapter, I'm really going to start liking it, which is scary because it's so close to, like, it's doing so badly on the table of contents.
Yeah, this is on the verge of cancellation already, which is just, it's really disappointing. It's not really any fault of its own. I mean, certainly if an amazing new series were to come along, it would fare well. So you can't say that it's no fault of the series' own, but we're at a time now where there are so many long-running established series in Jump that you basically have to come along with an amazing new series to really stand any chance of sticking around, because all the new series are fading fast. So, yeah, this was a decently enjoyable chapter, but it was not so enjoyable that I can feel confident that it's going to stay in Shonen Jump for a very long time. We're looking kind of at worrisome Lock-On and Yotsuya length again right away. I was a little bit weirded out by just how strangely scientific it got in this chapter, but I guess that does set it apart somewhat from just generic shonen fighting, so in that regard I don't really matter, or I don't really mind. I don't matter also, but I don't mind in this case. Let's take a look now at another new series, SWAT Chapter 2, which was largely about the Hard Hat Boy, Iwashita. Thoughts on this chapter, guys?
I think for, like, the side character who's supposed to be comic relief to start doubting himself in fights, I feel like it's a little bit indicative of what Jump has been doing recently, that they're canceling off shows quick if they don't produce immediate results. Mm. I feel like this was a bit rushed. I feel like it needed a bit more, like, just random humor chapters before it got to that. But I feel like this series is setting itself up way too quickly.
Yeah, I felt this from the first chapter. I felt that this series was just going at a pace that wasn't really good. You barely get introduced to characters, and then they're kind of just set up as, like, mainstays, like you've known them for like 20 or 30 chapters. And it's a little off-putting. It's weird.
Yeah, there was a lot of referencing of that in this chapter, even, where you had all these characters, you know, very, almost reverential of the main character for having defeated the bats. Like, that's really supposed to mean much to us. I mean, he beat them in one chapter. It's not as though it was this organization that we've been hearing about for chapters, dozens, hundreds of chapters even, that we knew their strength. It was, they showed up and they were defeated, and all of a sudden everyone in the school practically fears him over it. You're absolutely right, Drew, that it does seem as though they are deliberately rushing this plot so as to have any chance of capturing the imagination of the readers, and it's kind of backfiring in the sense that they're knocking off a character or a series of characters or a group that is only told to us to be strong does not achieve any sort of serious effect. Do we have any real promise for this series going forward, then? Any real interest in this one?
I mean, if this was a series that was 15 chapters in, I would probably make it to chapter 7 or 8 and then drop it. Like, that's the way it's going. It's just not very interest holding me yet. Maybe something will happen. They'll fix the pacing, try to take it slow, but I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Drew?
I think they're blitzing through it a bit too much. I'll certainly give it a follow because not all shows are good right off the bat, but I can think of like a couple of school-based comedies that have done better than this even to begin with.
Right. Well, that concludes our group discussion in This Week in Manga. I'm going to briefly discuss the series that only I read. Two chapters of Gintama to talk about this week, 314 and 315. You may only be able to find the raws and translations, not yet scanlations, but get them because they're pretty damn funny. This was a story about the shogun delivering a monkey to Kyubei, the rough and tumble swordswoman, and she's been ordered to house train this monkey and give it a name and everything that comes alongside it. A really excellently funny couple of chapters here. It really does well to read both chapters in quick succession because they are a short arc unto themselves. And the biggest recurring gag of this entire series of two chapters is that the monkey's name is never completely agreed upon, and they just keep adding more names to it. And so by the end of the second chapter, 315, the monkey's name is just absurdly... I'm going to read it for you. It's absurdly long. The monkey's name ends up being, and I quote, Jugem Jugem poop-throwing machine, Shinchan's day before yesterday underwear, Shinpachi's life, Balmonk Fazarian, Isaac Schneider, one-thirds pure feeling, two-thirds worried over a hangnail feeling, though betrayal knows my name. I know the unknown. The cuttlefish tastes like a different kind than it did last time because it was caught near the pond and served with oil from a hoofed mammal. Bichigusomaru. So, yeah, it was a very funny couple of chapters. I would strongly advise you to check those out. I hope that they're scanned soon, because it was really funny. Also, a tiny little bit touching, too, because of the relationship that forms between the monkey and Kyubei, but obviously that's not the focal point. The focal point is the comedy of the name. There's a lot of poop throwing, also, if that's what you're into. It was really funny. Katakyoshi Hitman Reborn 297, which is... showing off these characters, explaining the history of the Shimon family and their involvement with the Vongola family, then Vongola Primo. This is just, again, more and more plot lines being drawn between Tsuna and his group of Vongola and Vongola Primo and his group, which is just out of hand. Not every single thing that happens in this story needs to have been done by the first Vongola. It's absolutely ridiculous. And there's clearly some ties being drawn between Lambo knocking Enma's letter into the trash can. They're clearly setting up for some kind of other accidental occurrence having happened in the past that made it so that the Vongola family couldn't go and rescue the Shimon family. Clearly, this is all some kind of big misunderstanding. And then, yeah, you have the revelation of everyone's powered-up flames now that they've retrieved the Vongola's sin. Really, really apprehensive about where this is going. Not at all looking forward to it anymore. Kimi no Irumachi 96 was the aftermath of the slap. Really kind of an awkward conversation between Kiyomi and Haruto, but it kind of ended in a decently peaceful way where you end up with Kiyomi ends up as Eiba's love rival for Kazuma, even though... Eiba also has Haruto chasing after, so you have these four players now in this love quadrangle, which it turned out a lot better than I had been anticipating when Kiyomi was first introduced. It was resolved in an interesting enough way, particularly her quote-unquote apology, which wasn't one at all, but it was pretty good. And finally, Nurarihyon no Mago, Chapter 113, which is decidedly a step back after the recent chapters. We had a lot of really great action between Nura and the different members of Ishiyakiyako versus Tsuchigumo, and now you have these other guys coming in from the Tono family, and Tsurata realizing that she is not the only person to have contributed her fear to Nura, and so she just becomes like stupidly jealous and then won't help out anymore. It was kind of a bizarre touch of comedy where it absolutely didn't belong. I get the feeling that it's going to return very quickly to some solid action in the next couple chapters here, but this chapter was pretty disappointing. That concludes This Week in Manga. It is now time to discuss our chapters of the week. Clint.
My chapter of the week was One Piece 591. The reason being was it was just an amazing chapter with the reintroduction of Usopp and Chopper and seeing the island that Usopp was on, and it was just exactly where One Piece needed to go, and I'm ready to see more of the crew at this point.
True.
For me, it's Kakashi 313. I was extremely impressed by the big twist on the origin story that we originally got was pulled, and I just was really shocked by the little differences in story that we got to see.
And my chapter of the week, again, mimics Clint. Gotta stop doing this. But it's also One Piece, chapter 591. Totally echo everything Clint had to say about it. For me, loved all the scenes with Rayleigh, and I'm just extremely excited to find out what Chopper's amazing, shocking revelation was, presumably Luffy's increase in bounty. So very exciting. Admittedly, kind of a down week for other chapters to rival it, but this was strong enough to stand out on its own. So that concludes our episode this week. Thank you very much for listening. I'd like to remind you again, we're going to have a special episode this Wednesday, July the 14th, in which we'll take a look back at the first half of 2010, how series have progressed, where they were, where they are now, and how we feel about how they've gone. Current and classic reviews next week will be The World God Only Knows and MXO Final Flash.
Street Fighter 4 players, you better get your Adon ready because Gamer B just revalidated Adon.
I want me some despicable minions.
Now having successfully watched all 64 matches of the World Cup, I am now ready for the Premiership season. Come on, you Gunners. Thanks very much for listening. Good night.